This podcast is brought to you by MHA of Dutchess County and produced by CMJW Entertainment. This episode of the Vital Women of Washington Heights is proudly sponsored by Levia Med Spa.
You're listening to the Vital Women of Washington Heights.
Hello, everyone. My name is Iris Douglas, and my co-host here is Yvette O'Sullivan. And here's our producer today is Connor Walsh.
Hello. I'm in front of the camera today.
As Connor's going to introduce our special guest, but we welcome you back to the Vital Women of Washington Heights living in Dutchess County.
Yeah, no. So today is going to be such a great episode. With us today, we have an incredible writer and director. His film, Mad Bills to Pay, has been just going all over the film festival circuit. And we're going to be talking about the release, what it means, and how it's going to impact the community at large. So with us today, we have Joel Alfonso Vargas. Joel, how are you, my man? You're out in the UK right now, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Really honored to be having this conversation with you guys. Yes, I am in the UK, in London. I'm originally from New York, from the Bronx, but I've been living here for since the last 4 or 5 years.
Jeez. Well, hey, thank you for dealing with the time difference with us right now. Yeah. And of course, I'm going to hand it over to Yvette right now for her bochinche before we get into talking about your film.
Sure. Well, today's bochinche is that I know him as Joey. Joey and I are related. Joey's grandfather is my mother's brother. Therefore, Joey's grandfather is my uncle, and my mother and his grandfather are the only two living siblings out of nine. And recently, they had the opportunity to spend some time together because they're both in their 80s. And I knew Joey when he was 5 years old, and I haven't seen Joey since then, until he had his premiere of Mad Bills to Pay. And I don't think he remembered that at some point in his life, we had the opportunity to meet. And now it is such a joy to know him as an adult. And welcome to our show, The Vital Women of Washington Heights.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome, welcome, welcome. How excited are you to introduce Joey?
I'm very excited. This is a very proud moment for our family. And I know from spending time with my uncle this past summer, that he is extremely proud of his grandson. And in the Dominican community, they always have, no diga nada, pero él es mi favorito, which is something that they always say about, you know, their children, their grandchildren. And in English, what that means is, you know, don't say anything, but he's always my favorite. But they say that about all of us.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Like my mom's always like, oh, you know, it's just the same. I'm like, okay.
Do you think he saw something special in Joey when he was a little boy?
I'm sure he did. Joey was an extremely special young man growing up, and so special that he excelled in the public school system to the point that his teachers and also the principal, I know from stories that your mother has been able to share with me, recommended you to go to specialized schools. And from there, I believe that's where you started to explore the film industry.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really so much a specialized school. It was an alternative school, actually, but because I wasn't doing so well initially in high school in the Bronx, and I transferred to a high school in Manhattan. But it turned out that that school, it was like very, the process of getting into it was like super rigorous. You had to like interview and do like a logic exam and all this stuff. But it was a Montessori school, really. It was like modeled after a Montessori school. And like, so I went from a context that like, you know, that the classrooms were like 40 people in a classroom to like suddenly being with like 13, 14 kids. And you get like a lot of individualized attention. And because of how it was structured and, you know, the curriculum, there was a lot of arts programs. So I did playwriting, I did photography, and like eventually I learned about filmmaking, and that's really like how. But yeah, I mean, I always kind of had a, I was always drawn I always wanted to be a good student. But there was like a phase, you know, when I was maybe around or closer to Rico's age, who's the protagonist in Mad Bills, I had a like bit of a rebellious moment, and I was like hanging out with the wrong people and all that. And but yeah, kind of turned it around really fast. And yeah, I got out of that a scholarship. I was able to go to college in Pennsylvania. And there I initially went for engineering, but I quickly realized that it wasn't for me. And I studied filmmaking, and one thing led to another. And that's how I'm here, I guess.
I think as adolescent, we've always experience a moment where we rebel. And I think it's very normal. What is very commendable is if we're able to pull out of that stage and then find ourselves and become productive members of society. and not fall into the traps that sometimes are there, you know, for maybe an underserved population or from a neighborhood. Because Iris and I, we both come from Washington Heights, and they were some of our friends that didn't have the opportunity to get out of the neighborhood. And then there were others that had the opportunity of getting out, like Iris and I did.
Yeah, of course. But I think
that Joelle also had the opportunity that your family was like on it, you know, like, let's see how we can help Joelle be better. And that's what's up, you know, because that's how you got to, we're making a movie and you mad bills to pay. It's like everyone can resonate like that, you know, in the Bronx and in Washington Heights. So me personally, I don't know you, but I know your cousin here. I love her. And I'm so proud of you because that's a big accomplishment, you know, Dominicano from the Bronx, you know.
Yeah,
represent. Yeah, exactly. you know what's up. So I'm honored. I'm honored to be here.
So, Joelle, got a few questions about the film, of course. So you were mentioning around Rico's age, you found yourself in this rebellious period. Iris and I have yet to see the film. Mm-hmm. Only Yvette has out of this group, and we're all very excited. With that comparison of what you were saying in ages, would you consider that Rico or anybody else in the film is a self-insert, or is it a conglomeration of people or inspirations you've had in your life?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are some personal elements, of course, because I'm also the writer of the film. But really, the inspirations, they were like familial in the sense that I have a brother whose paternal brother is 12 years older than me, who was a teen dad at 17. My own mother was a teen mom, she was a teenager when she had my older brother, who's about a decade older than me. So, you know, I was thinking about their stories really when I was, I can't really tell you which came first. Was it, you know, the story or kind of like the memory of them? But it all happened around the pandemic. And I just remember just thinking a lot about that experience. And maybe it was because I was kind of then in my late 20s. I'm in my 30s now. But I was maybe the thought of parenthood and fatherhood and all this stuff, like maybe it was beginning to enter my mind. And I was just thinking, but I guess thinking a lot about their experiences and how hard it must have been for them to just navigate it all as young people, you know. Those are big choices to make, and you know, in their case, I don't know if I wouldn't be able to see, like, I don't think they were choices really, you know. It was probably accidents that led to some choices, but yeah, it just all seemed really, really complicated, and I wanted to explore that through the vehicle of a film.
You know, I want to share, and this is very personal. I know that when your mother had Kelvin, she was 16, and so was I, because we're only 3 months apart.
Born, really?
3 months apart, because I don't know, back then I have a load of cousins that they're all same mom, 3 months apart, 6 months apart. So I don't know what was happening during that time. But for me, watching your mother's experience from the outside, that was, first of all, we used to spend a lot of time together. So I went through a grieving process that I was not able to have the same kind of relationship that I had with her as a 16-year-old, and a birth control as well. Scared the heck out of me that here was somebody the same age as me, and now they had to deal with a baby, and her whole life was shift around the responsibilities. And at the same time that she was pregnant, one of my best friends also was pregnant, and she was 16 as well. So I had to wrap my head around this. And I'm like, I am mourning the loss of two people that are very close to my life. And it was very scary to see what they were going through. So thank you so much for putting all that information together and coming up with a film to showcase the struggles that young people go through, or teenagers, when they're not ready to become parents.
Absolutely. I definitely
appreciate the film, because I had a 16-year-old cousin male who was a father at 16, and his girlfriend was 14. And I saw where he had to kind of struggle and work at a discount store, work at the supermarket, and do this and do that to hustle it up just to get milk, bread, whatever, you know. So I'm excited about the film, because it's going to be relatable. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's going to be relatable a lot of other people too, for sure.
Absolutely. So we've been tiptoeing around it when we've been talking about elements of the film, but Joelle, could you give us a little bit of an overview? No spoilers, of course, but an overview synopsis of what exactly Mad Bills to Pay is about.
Yeah. I mean, so it's basically the story of a teenage couple navigating a teen pregnancy. It's a very simple story premise, but he's 19, she's a little bit younger than him, so it's kind of that's already one big problem that they have to overcome, but she's kicked out of her house and forced to move in with him. Basically, you know, the sort of apartment becomes a stage for kind of like their, you know, you could say kind of dysfunctional romance, as you would expect it to be for a couple of this age. I mean, that's all like happening against the backdrop of summer in the Bronx. And they sell these kind of cocktails that, if you're from New York, you're familiar with, called Nutcrackers. Like that's, you know, they do this kind of at Orchard Beach to get by, basically. And, you know, you're just basically seeing this kind of story, this window into this very, you know, I would say pivotal moment in these young people's lives unfold. And that's basically it.
That is really
amazing. Without going too into, like, I don't want to give spoilers or anything like this.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. But tell us about how your experience growing up in the Bronx influenced this, because, you know, when it comes to certain movies, like, I'm a big fan of Nolan's Batman trilogy. Gotham is very much a character as much as it is a setting. Would you say that you treated the Bronx the same way with this film?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It is a character. And in a way, it was intended as like a love letter to the Bronx and where I grew up. It's kind of ironic now because I don't live in the Bronx anymore. But like,
almost a farewell,
like,
then.
It's like that adage. Yeah, maybe, you know, but it's like, you know, you can't take the kid out the, you know, you can take the kid out the Bronx, but you can't take the Bronx out the kid. Like, the Bronx is always with me. And it's like part of my DNA. Like, I'm such a big fan of, like, you know, so many kind of things that have their origin in the Bronx, like hip hop and like graffiti culture, all that, you know, it's like that and Dominican culture really are what make up my identity. So yeah, like, I know, and a lot of the stories that I tell, you know, they have, at least the last three films I've made, they've had their setting in, or they were set in like either Uptown, Washington Heights, or the Bronx. You know, it's all kind of like the same kind of DNA, you could say. So yeah, super significant. And for me, it's like not only just a love letter, but it's like a record, because, you know, things are changing so rapidly in New York. So many neighborhoods are being gentrified. There is a cost of living crisis, you know, where just affordability is just, you know, inaccessible for a lot of people. And so who knows if, and, you know, I don't know, 10 years time, like, it'll exist in the same way. But it's like this kind of time capsule, you could say, as well.
Yeah. I like what you said about record too. I know what you're saying in the time capsule kind of way, but when I first pictured it, as you said, kind of like a vinyl record, how certain things always spin around. When it comes to New York City, obviously I don't live there, but I've seen a lot of the changes. Number of people who are currently there or have been around says, like, this reminds me of the New York City of the 70s. This reminds me of this. So it's just interesting how certain things come back around cyclical at the same time as well. We'll see if people will learn from their past, if it will continue to grow, if it'll devolve, how things will look in, as you said, 10 years, 20 years, whatever that might be. Again, I'm not from New York City. I'm from upstate, but we'll go from there. I'll pass it off to people who actually have lived in the city for our follow-up questions.
Well, that was part of why I enjoyed your film so much, because where you shot specific scenes, I was like, oh, I've been there. Oh, yes, you know, as a teenager. So you're showing so much the beauty of the Bronx, Orchard Beach, and the lifestyle, and just the whole community, how people sometimes help each other and support each other, and also how some people could care less, you know, whether you're riding the train or whether you fall on the street and they just keep walking by and don't stop, you know, to see if they can help you. So I felt you capture a lot of the Bronx and New York City life, and that's what makes your movie so real.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, and that was completely, you know, the intention. I just wanted to really stay true to my experiences, like, and memories of life in the Bronx. So like that part came easy. I think and one of the questions that you guys sent me, it was like, how did you capture this sort of like naturalism? It was just like that, you know, I was trying to be as honest as possible. Like I truly made the film with no other audience in mind, but the audience from, you know, where I grew up, like, you know, that it resonates so much. Yeah. That it resonates so much internationally. Like that's, you know, that's a different thing, but you know, I think it goes to show just how, when you are very honest and specific about an experience of that, you know, that resonates, you know, that people will connect to it, you know.
It's relatable to a lot of people, definitely, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm super excited because I lived in Throgs Neck in the Bronx.
Oh, wow.
So
okay, cool.
Like 15 minutes away from Orchard Beach. So I'm super excited to see the film, I'm excited to find out what's next, you know, like, what do you want to do next, you know?
You know, it's like it's been such a great journey this year. So many opportunities, kind of things that, you know, have manifested for years and, you know, that are materializing and things. So the next step, of course, will be another film, just a follow up to this. Basically just trying to find put together the financing. And, you know, you kind of have to go through the same journey with the next project, but the hope is that because this one has been as successful as it has been, that it'll that journey will get a little bit easier. So that's the, like, without I don't want to share too much because things are very much in the early stages, but there's a follow-up to this film, hopefully 2027 2028.
That's great. That's very exciting. Yeah. Speaking about real and raw, one thing that I was able to identify with are some of the scenes with dysfunction.
Yes. Say again? Yeah.
With the dysfunction in the family dynamics. And I find, you know, my background is in social work. And not only is there dysfunction in Dominican families, but in other culture as well. Do you feel that what you're portraying in the movie, do people from other cultures resonate with the dysfunctional family?
I think, you know, you could say that every family is to a certain degree dysfunctional. I don't, you know, it would be like a perfectly functioning family. I think that's an ideal, doesn't exist. People have clashes, like there are clashes between siblings or clashes between, you know, parents, you know, it's, you know, which is natural because you have, like, I don't know, however big a family is, you know, 4 people, 5 people, 10 people living, you know, under one roof, like inevitably there's going to be conflict. So, you know, I think people do resonate with that on, you know, internationally. What I found though is that, like, in, you know, I guess Latin derived cultures, like, you know, like people from in Europe, like for example, Southern Europe, like Italy and like Portugal and Spain, like they kind of connect because I feel like, you know, the communication is just a bit like spicier. And I think, you know, Dominicans obviously are derived from that culture as well.
Fireworks.
Yeah, fireworks. yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think people also connect to the film, you know, on a thematic level as well, because you have, you know, we live in a world where, you know, the economic disparities are kind of, they keep growing and growing, you know, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. There's a lot of divide there. And, you know, there are many places in the world, there are families that look like Rico's family, you know, maybe there are teen fathers and so on, you know, families that are really like struggling to survive in very expensive kind of hyper modern cities.
Well, the fact that you bring that up, I want to talk about Rico's character and the hustle that he has in the film, and it can kind of be looked down upon. I know that there are some illegal facets to it. So what kind of commentary were you looking to portray in what Rico has to do just to make ends meet?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going back to what I was saying earlier about kind of a cost of living crisis and a lot of these big cities, you know, London is one of them for sure. You know, people have to resort to alternative means of sort of, you know, of making an income. And, you know, I think that, you know, there is the gig economy, right, where you do have, you know, like these sort of tech jobs where people are doing, you know, maybe, you know, Uber Eats or whatever it is. But then you have kind of like the informal or DoorDash. Yeah.
Yep, I've done that.
Yeah. You know, people have to do what they have to do to survive, to supplement their incomes. But you also have the informal economy, which is just like completely outside of that, which is, you know, it's a spectrum. You have, like, for example, I have an aunt from my dad's side who, like, she, you know, she lives in Manhattan, and basically she, her gig is to, she makes soaps at home, face soaps, and she sells these soaps on the corner. Now she has like an Etsy store and she's like, but it's like these kinds of, and you know, that's the very innocuous end of that spectrum. And then you have the more extreme end, which is like, you know, the more problematic stuff. Maybe you're drug dealing, maybe you're doing, you know, some, you know, all as a means to survive. And of course, like, Rico's hustle exists within that spectrum. That's kind of on the one hand. On the other hand, yeah, like, it's also, Rico comes from a community that has been alienated, you know, like in the sense of like access has been kind of a bit harder to come by, and underserved, you know, whether that's like through education or, you know, maybe there are language barriers, like things that, you know, perhaps lead one to being underqualified for a good job, you know, and, you know, as a result of that, then, you know, the informal economy becomes your only option. And I don't think that's exclusive to like the Dominican community or any community. I think every immigrant group has kind of gone through that sort of road. You know, you think about the Irish immigrants, you know, like, you know, think about like Gangs of New York, you know, something like that. You know, it's just like people have had their, you know, and, you know, eventually through the generations, people assimilate and kind of, and so on. So it's really an that's the story of America. You know, I think with Latino populations, it's just, you know, we're a bit younger here, and, you know, that this is what we're going through now, but it's not things that are completely alien and removed to what others have gone through. I think with people of color, it's a little bit more complicated though, because I think assimilation is a lot harder to kind of integrate into, to gain access and to integrate into kind of, you know, mainstream jobs and so on. And I think that as a result of that, you know, it could be that, you know, you're three generations in, four generations in, and you're still, the informal economy is still your only option, you know? And that's, you know, that's the harsh reality, you know? And
it's difficult and it's bad. As you said, we're getting poorer, like that's putting people into these holes, and it's heartbreaking, but I'm glad that you're being able to tell these stories. I know I've been jumping in a lot. Would you, anything else you guys?
I just want to say that I'm happy. I mean, the more you kind of share your experience on why you created this movie, I'm really happy, because people need to know, you know, the struggle is real, but you can also get out of it. You know, you can also get out of it, and you got to figure it out how to get out of it. So I'm happy, you know, you're young, you're Latino, and this is a big accomplishment.
Well, it's a powerful message. But on a lighter note, can you tell us, how did you go through selecting your actors? And, you know, being someone that saw the film, the actors, of course, are not the age that they are portraying. But I thought that they did a phenomenal job. Yeah. And I know from the interview that some of the actors, and I forget who exactly, acted for the first time. And I was surprised to hear that, because I was like, wow, I thought that they were a professional, you know, actor. So tell us more about your process and your selection, and basically how all of this is done, because I don't understand it and I would like to know how it all works.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thanks for the question. I think authenticity was kind of like my, like, I guess, key idea with this whole thing. You know, I wanted to keep it as true to life as possible. And I knew that in order to make a film that felt authentic, that felt raw, that felt real, I had to kind of cast from within the community. Now, I couldn't go to, like, you know, some kind of like casting agency and kind of, you know, that just wouldn't have worked for the kind of film I wanted to make. So the process initially entailed just having to, like, it's called street casting. So basically, you know, we were just going out, you know, to Orchard Beach, to Washington Square Park, like all over New York City, where young people kind of got together and were approaching people like, hey, do you want to be in a movie? You want to be, you know, like people who we thought were interesting. And then we'd get submissions, like basically like self tapes submitted through like Instagram or whatever it is. And then that's how we began to kind of narrow our pool. And then eventually we started to chemistry test people. So that's just basically seeing how people work together, you know, as a family unit, for example, at a facility in Midtown. And yeah, like little by little, you know, and this all occurred in the course of like a 4-week period. But we found our family. In the end, it wasn't like fully street cast. The mother, for example, who's played by Joanna Florentino, she was someone who was in my orbit. She's a theater actress. She, you know, she does some screen work as well. But we've always wanted to work together. Natalie came through a more traditional avenue as well. Juan, you know, has a bit of experience.
Can you tell us who Juan and Natalie?
Yeah. Sorry. Natalie Navarro plays the sister. Juan Collado plays Rico. So Juan also has come from a sort of a community theater background, done some screen acting. And Destiny Checo, who plays Destiny, the girlfriend. She's the one who's truly like a non-actor. So we found her on TikTok. She was doing like these like lip sync. I don't know if you guys are familiar with these like these lip sync reels to scenes in popular movies. It's not even her own voice. It's just like she's only acting with her face, but it was so phenomenal that we were just like, okay, we have to see this girl.
And Destiny is not 16, and she was playing the role of a 16-year-old, and I thought she did a phenomenal job, because when she told me this is my first acting gig, I was surprised because for her to truly show the feelings of what a 16-year-old can go through when she's going through a pregnancy, I was just like, I was like, what? Not really?
Yeah. You know, I think that was a beautiful thing. They all took like a lot of ownership over their roles, and it was such a collaborative process. Similarly, Juan, he's like in his 30s, you know, like, and he's playing a 19-year-old, you know. It's just somehow we were all able to channel the sort of inner teenager in us, and deliver a strong film. But yeah.
Cool. You've mentioned the collaborative process with everything. Yeah. I'm just curious, when you guys were filming, you being the writer and director, what was it like to be able to craft these characters once you finally had the actors in place, you're filming? Was there room for improv? Was there room for changing the script a little bit? And it's like, oh, yeah, I feel this way about this character. How did that look like by the time you actually got on set and started shooting?
100%. Like, I kind of come from a documentary background, and I have like this real allergy to like things that feel like scripted and fake. Like, you know, I can appreciate it, but it's just not those are not the kinds of films I want to make. So out the gate, we knew that we were going to improvise and that it was going to be, emulative more of like a documentary process. In the rehearsals, like, we had a script, like it was semi-scripted, but in the rehearsals, I was like, no, we're going to break this. And, you know, with the cast, basically we just rewrote every scene, you know, in a way that felt more organic to them, or how they would say something or whatever it was. You know, I just wanted everything to feel super fluid. That's you know, what you see in the film.
How important was it for everyone to have like the same mindset and have the same energy for you?
Yeah. I mean, it's so important. I think as a director, that's kind of like what you're directing. Like, you want everyone to just be in sync, like for there to be synergy and working toward the same goal, you know, and like, you're like directing morale. I think that's really what it is, you know? So it's really like, it's it's a lot of leadership involved in that sense, you know, sometimes more so than like creativity. But you got to get, you know, a whole crew of people and a cast, or like in our case it was a 16-day shoot, but on bigger, you know, longer productions, it could be months, it could be, like if you're doing one of those like a really elaborate series like Game of Thrones, for example, you know, that's, you know, you're doing that for 9 months, you know, so, you know, you're gonna have all these ups and downs, but you gotta still instill in people, regardless of whatever, that, you know, they gotta keep, there's a reason why you're doing this, and
them in good spirits, right? Thank you.
Yeah.
So can you tell us what was the most challenging part about creating this film?
I think the balance of having a very limited amount of time and limited resources, like the reality of that. Mm-hmm. And then having to balance that with like my needs as a director, which is, you know, and my goals really, which are to like deliver a quality film. So to get quality performances and all that. It was just always like a dance, you know. It never felt like there was enough time and enough like money and resources to do things. But I think in how the film is shot, which I know Iris and Connor, you haven't seen the film, but that you have, like, you know, it's single setups. So which means that there's only one angle ever, like on a scene. We're never cutting to like a close up or whatever it is. You know, it's just always one angle, and that allowed us to move through our schedule very quickly and give me a bit of freedom to try new things from take to take. And then I kind of, as the director, I kind of made this like promise to myself, or I had this agreement with myself, which was like, never move on from a scene without you getting what you need, or like at least there being a nugget of something that you can use, because then otherwise you're just wasting everyone's time, you know? So it's like, you kind of have to like, so you're fighting these two battles on consistently throughout a production. So that was the hardest thing for me. But there were also a lot of challenges involved in shooting in New York, and, you know, navigating. It was done very guerrilla. So, you know, in some places we had permits, and other places we didn't have permits. So it was like a lot of that, you know, indie filmmaking stuff.
Tell us the part. I know during your interview after premiering the film here in New York, you spoke about how, I believe, one of the equipments was carried in a backpack. Was it the camera or the speaker? And I was like, oh, that's very creative.
Yeah, yeah. We had like a real, you know, heavy duty like movie camera, you know, kind of top of the line equipment. But we really stripped it down to like just its bare essential. So it was like, because we just wanted to be as inconspicuous as possible. So like all the gear that, you know, you would normally put in front of a lens, like, you know, the we took off so that it could fundamentally just be like a box and a lens, and that's it. And then we had a battery running through a backpack through with a cable. And that was the whole setup. So like, we could just literally get away with murder with that. So we could shoot anywhere. No one would
modified.
You tried to put it all together. That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that
you
was
have to figure it out, right? When you want something done, right?
Exactly. 100%. You know, so
I'm very curious to see this film just to begin with, but the more we're talking about it, I'm excited. You mentioned about how each scene is just shot from one view. I really find that interesting with your, as you said, you had a documentary background. I feel like that is a very voyeuristic way of approach to that, where it's like, we're really encroaching on these people's lives. I'm assuming besides just a, besides the challenges that you had when it comes to filming time and resources, that must've been an artistic choice as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it absolutely was an artistic choice in the sense that I was trying to avoid looking at a lot of like cinematic references. I didn't want the film to feel like your typical New York City film that, you know, I don't know, like if you're a fan of like the Safdie brothers, like Uncut Gems or whatever, you know, it's like these films are so like energetic and like to the point that they're kind of like, they're great films, but I'm just like that, and all credit, like that is a New York City experience. But my experience of New York City was like, growing up in the Bronx was kind of sleepy, was kind of slow in the summer, you're just hanging out on the stoops, you know? So I wanted to capture just like that kind of languidness of how life can feel in that part of New York. But in addition, like we were also, or I was looking at photography a lot as like a key kind of, I wanted the film to feel really like a series of photographs in a sense, like you're looking through a photo album of this family's life. You could speak on this as well, but like, you know, the film feels like, you know, you're getting these snapshots of this sort of, this family.
When you said that there's a sequel, I'm excited because the way that the film ended, I'm like, now what? I want more. Yeah. So it's very exciting that you will give us more. And the fact
it's not really a sequel. So sorry to clarify. Like, it's just, okay. I mean, I hope to do that, you know, maybe in like 10 years time. You know? I was like, I would even call it like Destiny's Child, you know, like it would be like, just to kind of keep it, you know.
It's the type of storyline that at least for me, it left me wanting to know where Rico is at, because there's a particular scene that if I could get into his head and know what he was thinking at that moment.
Yeah.
So I want to know more. I want to know what Rico is going to do.
I think, you know, in a way I hear you, but in another way, like I think that's, it's also the power of the film, because we don't want to resolve that story. I think that story is so complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all seen it play out like very positively and very negatively. You know, I think as maybe people from that community, we have to think on it positively. I genuinely hope that their relationship works out. But I'm honestly, as a filmmaker, I'm more curious in how, other people kind of like, how they interpret that. I want people to come to their own understanding of what that story is. I don't want to like spoon feed them.
Well, we'll speak privately and I'll tell you how I think his life is going to unfold.
You would be able to tell me. I don't know.
Yes. So tell us about the Spanish title. The Spanish title, I flipped my page. What is it? Dile que no soy malo. Destiny, dile que no soy malo. Why is not the same translation as to the English title? Why did you go with that particular title in Spanish?
I mean, it's a bilingual film. So I wanted people to like, at first impression, know that it is a bilingual film. It's, you know, English and Spanish. So that's like off the jump. Like, and both titles, like Mad Bills to Pay is inspired by like a lyric, that's like a Biggie lyric. Dile que no soy malo, not the Destiny part, but dile que no soy malo. That comes from, I think like a Luis Vargas, like bachata. You know, I'm kind of playing with kind of different song lyrics, but I think for me personally, there's like there is a deeper meaning, because growing up in a single parent household, like my mom, and I think many, many people can probably relate, but she always had an opinion about my dad. Let's leave it like that. And
most women that have experienced divorce, or maybe their relationship hasn't worked out with their partner, they have an opinion about that person.
And so, like, you know, you kind of, for me, like growing up as a young man, I was like, oh yeah, you know, my dad is this and that, and you know, my mom was really the one who, you know, provided for us, and kind of, you know, and you know, of course, you know, she wasn't perfect, and you know, like, how could you be as a single
parent? Love her no matter what.
In case she
happens to see this, we love
her. No, of course, like I love my mom more than anything, you know. You know, in terms of like my dad, like I kind of always grew up with this like prejudice about him. And then, you know, the older you get, like, especially coming from like a place as I'm an artist, you know, I'm always dealing in like nuance and gray areas. So like that, like you learn a person's context, and like you think back, you think about, or you learn from like other family members, like how he was raised, and, you know, all the things that he'd gone through, that doesn't excuse his behavior, absolutely not. But, you know, it just kind of, it maybe makes you empathize a little bit more with that. Like I think, like, maybe if I were going through the same things, I'd be the same person. I don't know.
There's always two sides of a story.
What'd you say?
There's always two sides of a story.
Yeah.
His perspective, and then there's your mom's perspective.
Yeah. So destiny dile que no soy malo, or dile que no soy malo, means tell them I'm not a bad guy. So that's like, you know, it's almost like Rico is, you know, when you watch the film, you realize, oh yeah, that's Rico communicating to the audience through the title, you know, just tell them I'm not a bad guy, you know? And that's the idea. And I was so interested in thinking, you know, the whole, you could say that what kicked off this whole journey in a way is trying to understand, like, a character, I guess, like my dad, you know, like, you know, he's a very complicated person, kind of not always the most likable person, you know, like Rico is not, you know, the whole film, you guys will know when you see it, but, you know, you're just like, you just want to really just, you know,
you want to strangle him.
Yeah. Like, kind of get it together, like, make the right choice. But, you know, at every turn, he's kind of not doing that. And yeah, you know, that's basically.
Well, I can definitely appreciate the fact, you know, the single mom. I was also raised by a single mom, and my mom was always tu papa. You know, it was always like your father. So yeah, I could definitely appreciate that. But I've learned throughout the years that you got to kind of have compassion for them, you know, because they weren't mentally or physically or at the same level where you're at now. So I appreciate. I can't wait to see the film. And thank you.
Yeah.
So as we're getting towards the end of this interview, normally I'm behind the camera saying how many minutes we have left, but something that I'm very curious about, we haven't touched on yet. As we said in the very beginning, you were going around in the festival circuit. What kind of reactions have you been getting from people through that? And what about the whole festival experience? Have you been enjoying or not enjoying while showing this film?
I mean, that's a loaded question, but just to try to answer as simply as possible, like, it's the reaction. We've shown the film like in every corner of the world. It feels like, you know, we've been to Tokyo, we've been to South Korea, we've been in Europe, we've been in Latin America, we were in Brazil, we were, you know, all over the States. So, like, truly blessed to have that experience. Again, with a film that, you know, our expectation was just like, we just wanted to make a film that, like, told the story, and with only one audience in mind, so that, again, that it resonates. It's like, whoa, that's awesome. But it's been so great just to show that film to different audiences, and just to kind of get a sense of, like, what the cultural and, like, what resonates, like, what's the cultural reaction, like, like in South Korea, you know, like, there's a joke in the film where, you know, towards the end, Rico, you know, he has this crazy idea that where he wants to name the baby Samsung, you know, and then, like, you know, it's just, for me, it was just like a throwaway line that we kind of found, like, in, like, the improv. But in South Korea, it was like, it, like, tore the roof off the movie theater. Like, people were so, and then for the whole film before then, like, they were just so serious as well. Like, you know, I was like, do they like this film? I'm not sure, you know, but, like, and then at that film festival, we ended up winning, like, the grand prize. And so it was, like, really cool. But, you know, when we showed it in Europe, when we've been showing it in Europe, you know, like in Germany and Austria, like, the reading is always, like, a little bit more political. People want to know more about, like, the I guess, like, the social political themes, you know, behind it. And in the US is more like, I think the reactions we get is, like, people who especially are Latino, like, feel very seen and you know, like, even when the title, when the opening credits, because it's, I don't know if you know who Tokisha is, she's a reggaeton artist from Dominican Republic, but, like, the her music is the title music of the film. And when that comes on, people just, like, you know, like,
they want to get up and dance.
It's basically that. So that's so kind of beautiful. It's just, so beautiful to see just how people, how different audiences respond to it. For me personally, though, like, to answer your question about, like, what maybe are the other drawbacks or downsides, like, it's just been really tiring just having to do all that whole tour. Like, I've been doing that for, like, 10 months, you know, like, and, you know, staying in hotel rooms and all that. So, like, that's kind of, I feel like I just need to chill out and focus on my health for a little while. But you know, super blessed to do it. And definitely.
Well, I'm sure it's also been fun, because tell us a little bit about Pablo, your producer. He's a lot of
Pablo.
Fun.
Pablo.
So at least you have that fun side that you can enjoy when you guys are not out promoting the film.
Yeah. You know, we've had a lot of fun kind of, like, just, you know, we've just I think our networks have just expanded so much in this year, and we've just met so many interesting people, like, you know, who we want to collaborate with, or just, you know, like, generally just great people in the audience who are just like, oh, you know, can, you know, treat you to a drink or whatever it is, you know. And so, like, yeah, it's been really affirming for us, you know. I think that's the word I would use, this whole process, like, because you go through, like, when you're coming up, I guess, you're always so insecure, like, oh no, like, you know, maybe this is a pipe dream, maybe, like, you know, I didn't like to get to the other side, maybe slightly, because, you know, we're still at the beginning. You know, it feels like, oh shit, you know, we're not that crazy, like, we've got to keep going, you know. So
thank you, going.
Yeah. Well, we probably have 1 minute left, because I know normally you give a 5 minute warning.
We're
so
towards the end.
Would you like to leave the audience with some conclusion or action?
Yeah, maybe, like, I could, like, my call to action would be, the film is going to be out in the tri-state area in the spring. Can't yet disclose the date, but look out for it. Mad Bills to Pay or Destiny de la Gana Soy Malo in a cinema near you. Please come out, support the film. And if you want to, you know, get in touch or learn more about me, you know, I'm on social media or whatever, just reach out. I'm always up for a chat. So
Thank you so much, Joey, for taking the time to do this interview with us.
Yeah. Thank you, Joey. Really appreciate you. And
thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Lots of other things that you're going to do, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by MHA of Dutchess County and produced by CMJW Entertainment. Thank you once again to this episode's sponsor, Levia Med Spa.